Hi, and welcome to another episode of The Leadership Enigma. Now, please go on to the YouTube channel. We're putting all the back catalogue out there, so please subscribe so you don't miss anything. You can check out all of our episodes on the major podcast platforms as well, but you already know that. We now have over 150 episodes as we keep investigating the best in class from leaders all over the world. And sometimes we have to explore not only the best in class, but the inconvenient truth. So I've been looking forward to this episode as I have the wonderful Chandra Nair with me, who is based in Hong Kong. He's the founder of the Global Institute for Tomorrow, which is an independent pan-Asian think tank. Trust me, you don't want to miss this episode. Come back to me just after this break.
You're listening to The Leadership Enigma, powered by Transform Performance International. A podcast for the insatiably curious to explore the power of human-centered leadership to create real momentum for positive and sustainable change. Whether you're an entrepreneur, business owner, or corporate executive, each week we speak to global experts, academics, rising stars, ambitious upstarts, and disruptors as we discover that success leaves clues. Now, here's your host, Adam Pacifico.
So Chandra, it's a warm welcome to the Leadership Enigma. How are you?
I'm very well. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Now, Chandra, I have not done any justice with that very brief introduction. I'm so sorry that you and I didn't get the opportunity to meet in person when I think I was in Hong Kong and then Thailand, but you were working in Bali. So in some ways, we were ships in the night. But help everyone understand a little bit about Chandra.
There's not much to it. Maybe I'll start by talking a bit about my organization, the Global Institute for Tomorrow.
Yes.
Well, I've been a consultant for most of my life. I led and grew Asia's largest environmental sustainability and risk consultancy before that became a fad. And then about 15 years ago, I exited the consultancy arena. I was the chairman for the Asia Pacific region.
Yep.
And I created the Global Institute for Tomorrow, a kind of pan-Asian think tank, mainly driven by what we all know today. But I had a view that much of what we understood in Asia about the future was needed to be redefined, and we needed new ways of thinking about that. And I wanted to create a sense of urgency and a different way of thinking that was a departure from the sort of conventional, and I say it carefully, Western-led narratives about leadership and progress.
And was there a catalyst for that desire to start the think tank, Chandra, or in some ways was it an interest that accumulated over a number of years in the work you were doing and the people that you were meeting? Was there something that made that change?
I think it was the latter, a catalyst of many things. I was brought up, I was born in Malaysia, the one of eight. My parents are migrants from India.
Yes.
So I saw a lot of things. Then I came over to the UK to do my degree. I worked in London for a few years. And at that point, then I London was a very different place from what it is today. There was a huge amount of what I think was blatant street violence, racism, et cetera. And so I just didn't think that was for me. And I didn't want to fight that battle because I was getting involved and interested with African students in what was going on in Southern Africa. So I went to Southern Africa and got involved in that struggle of the liberation struggle, but having a daytime job as a volunteer, because I'm a chemical engineer by training. So I got involved in water supply, sanitation, and healthcare. So all of that sort of learning over a long period of time, then I got involved in environmental consultancy. I had the opportunity to grow the region's largest consulting firm. I got to understand the threats that were coming. But yet at the same time, as a consultant and heading up a large organization, there were limits to what I could say and do within the confines of that. And so that resulted in me deciding that I should create an independent think tank. I looked across the region There wasn't much that cut deep into what I call the intellectually robust analysis of where we are.
Now, Chandran, I'm curious in where your curiosity comes from, because as you say, you've lived and been to many parts of the world. You've seen things that are not good, that are not helping the world. You've been very passionate in relation to trying to, in some ways, become an activist in those areas. And that might not be the right way of describing it. But where does that level of curiosity or that heightened sense of injustice come from, Chandran?
Yeah, I was going to say, when you first mentioned curiosity, I was going to say it comes from a sense of appreciation of the large-scale injustice in the world. And I suppose, and you could, some might call it naive, a view that these things can be solved. Yet we don't solve them because we have bought into narratives that are so dishonest, because they preserve certain privileges. And I'm happy to talk about that in relation to business, politics, geopolitics, between rich nations, poor nations, between elites and non-elites. But it was the sense of the huge amount of injustice, an early sense of the, also without having that time, the scientific understanding of the rapid nature by which we were degrading the world. And that's not simply an environmental discussion. And through that, the understanding that we needed to, you know, do something else and channel the frustration and anger through engaging with people, through sound analysis, discussion, and with arguments that could be mainstreamed so that others could essentially build on it. And that's where that curiosity came from, that sense of, we can't fix these things, but we're trapped.
Okay.
In a world of intellectual dishonesty.
Well, and which is why we're definitely calling this episode An Inconvenient Truth, or perhaps multiple inconvenient truths. Now, Chandran, I know that you're asked to talk all over the world. I think we joked before we actually went on the episode that sometimes you're asked to speak all over the world, but there's a slight fear or trepidation as regards some of the truths you may present to the audience. Many areas that we could talk about, and we'll only be able to talk about a few, but let me start with sustainability and the environment, because that is something that you focused on early on. It's something that you've mentioned already. So talk to me a little bit about, because you also used the word fad, because it's on everybody's lips at the moment, isn't it? Sustainability or ESG, and in the corporate environment, it's high on many priorities, or certainly it's vocalized as being high. But just tell me some of the things that you're seeing at the moment in relation to the issue of the environment and sustainability across the world.
It's going to be difficult to keep this answer short, but I'll try.
That's all right.
But I'll first start by saying that word, as you said, sustainability, is now one of the most abused terms. A lot of people don't understand it. I don't even understand the science. So I one of the things that I feel we need to call out, and I wrote a piece for Fortune about 2 months ago saying, where's the science in all the corporations in terms of leading what they call ESG? There are very few scientists that I ever meet. They're lawyers and communication experts, very few scientists, but you need to understand the science.
Okay.
If you don't understand the science, you're flying blind and you become intellectually actually dishonest. So sustainability for me is the fundamental question, and I don't want to keep this long, is to understand whether we live in a planet with about 8 billion people.
Mm-hmm.
We can't have it all. The idea that somehow there's there are technology fixes to all of this, and financial fixes to all of this through ESG, etc., is a lie. And the inconvenient truth is that most of the people who are in the world going, if you look at 2050 in a population of 10 billion, most of those people will be in the developing world, to use a simple phrase.
Right.
And most of those people cannot and should not aspire to live lives taken for granted in the Western world or in the rich nations of Asia like Japan, etc. But the question then is, what can they have? And so that is the policy challenge. But intellectually, very few want to talk about it because it starts to bring into the realm of sustainability the questions of rights and freedoms. Not everyone can have everything. Then what political systems do you have that allow people to have the basic rights, but also understand there are constraints?
Now, Chandran, obviously I live and work in the West, so in many ways I'm immersed in the narrative of the West. What am I missing then, Chandran, if I'm immersed in that narrative and I'm not seeing perhaps what I should be seeing or hearing from other areas of the world? As you say, the majority of the population will actually not be in the West or be in the developing world. So help me understand what it is that I'm missing as well, not through any mischief, but just simply perhaps not aware of what I should be aware.
That's a great question. I mean, I think the first thing before I talk about one example of what you're maybe not aware is firstly, we need to be very careful and almost reject the slogans that accompany much of the sustainability discussion. For example, the myth of net zero. There's no such thing. But yet this has been mainstreamed. Scientists know it, yet many scientists just use the term because it's politically convenient. And most of these are people in the West, and then it's exported to the rest of the world. But to just give you an example of what you're missing, I mean, India will be the most populated country in the world in the next few years. I think India's population is just about surpassed out of China, that of China. India will have over 1.5 billion people. So what people are missing is, for instance, today, and my Indian friends, I hope, will not be annoyed by what I'm saying and saying, "Oh my God, how can you say that?" But more than half the population of Indians do not have access to proper housing, houses they own. And I'm not talking about a nice terrace home house in London or even in Hong Kong. None of that. A basic housing. So they have a right to that. And what we take for granted, people like you and me who are privileged, is that it would come with electricity. My computer would turn on. My lights would be on a hot day. I might be able to turn on the air con. And there'll be water supply, it'll be clean, it'll be portable, etc. Most people don't have. In fact, most of the world doesn't have. But to start with the home, the abode, the basic human right of to bring security, etc., we'll need a complete revolution in terms of materials used and how India will go about it. The current economic model that we are all bought into is trickle-down economics. That's also, part of what I call the big lies that exist. Trickle-down economics will never, ever allow 1.5 billion Indians, of whom about half fall into the category I just mentioned, to own just a decent home. And we're not talking about 1,000 square foot or something like that, maybe 450 square foot, but decent, provides dignity and allows people to have water and sanitation. That isn't happening through the current economic model of trickle down, which is you go and work for a company, you save some pennies, you get HSBC to then give you a mortgage. It's not happening or Barclays. That's what we're missing. But so there's a political answer to that, which is thinking about the economy different. But the other dilemma is the issue that the materials needed for all of them will also cause huge disruptions to the environment. You can't build the millions of homes needed to fulfill the basic rights of hundreds of millions of Indians by calling it net zero and carbon neutral. This ain't happening. So emissions are going to rise if these people are going to have their basic needs met. That is a conundrum. So talking in the West about net zero and renewable energies, etc., it's all fine and good. But the reality in India and many other parts of the world is very different. So that's a sort of discussion that is missing,
So in some ways
I
we've,
hope.
yeah, no, forgive me, Chandran. So in some ways we've got an oxymoron that actually, if there is discussion in relation to net zero, actually the reality of trying to bring, you say, half a billion people or more out of poverty to give them just the very basic needs in life offsets that. And I suppose what we're actually talking about then is reality versus perception. So do you find that you have a bigger challenge in talking to Western leaders and organizations, or bigger challenges talking to Eastern leaders and organizations?
I have challenges talking to both. It depends on the forum. There are certain business forums where there is, and this is the intellectual dishonesty that I talk about, where they don't want to hear this. And this is where, when I come and speak, I'm a very uncomfortable pain, because most of these people are not stupid. They know the truth. But the forums are essentially entertainment gigs, if you can call it, or public relations exercises. Everyone's going to sign up. We care about the world, et cetera, et cetera. But they are illogical in that sense. I mean, another example of what I'll talk to you and I take for granted, the flush toilet, waterborne sewage. I mean, I'm not even talking about the Japanese version, which is, can be remote controlled and even, talks to you. Just talking about the basic ones. Most people in the world cannot have this, will not be able to have it. Most of the world is unsanitized. So when we talk about, with the pandemic, the first thing we've all told is hygiene, wash your hands. But for most people in the world, washing your hands with portable water is beyond reach. And I mean portable water, meaning clean water. But even if you have access to water, then you've got to treat that stuff. And I would argue, although, they're varying numbers, but something like 60 to 70% of all wastewater around the world is not treated and disposed according to WHO standards. So you imagine that today, 8 billion people, I mean, visit the toilet on average 7 or 8 times a day. And a minority of us flush it, but most of it is not flushed, or even if flushed, it's not treated. So that's just an example of the conundrum we face in all of this. So when I have to speak to people about this in Asia, if I go to developed capitals, they want to pretend that they have now embraced the modality of Western standards. And I remind them, 2 hours away from the capital, people are living lives that are pre-industrial in terms of the basic rights. And that's a sustainability conundrum. How are you going to bring water to them? How are you going to bring these? And that provision of the services is both a basic right, but also a fundamental need to sustain the natural environment, in this case, water and surface waters and the oceans, et cetera. It's just part of the example of the scale of the dilemma. It should not be simplified by slogans.
And Chandran, you've got me thinking as well, and I'm interested in your perspective here. As you travel the world and you talk to leaders and talk to, large global organizations, part of me wants to believe that there's no deliberate blindness in relation to some of these issues. But there's certainly the issue, isn't there, of out of sight, out of mind. It's so easy to get consumed with your own life and your own reality and your own challenges. What do you think is behind this? Can you actually get a sense of why this is going on, that there is not a ready acceptance to some of these inconvenient truths that you are sharing, in the talks that you give?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very good question. As you said, we all hope there isn't deliberate denial. There isn't deliberate denial. But I would say there's an element of deliberate denial. And then, more importantly, there is just that even those we call leaders, and I've spoken to many, I won't name them, I've been on platforms with some of the most prominent people. There is a reason to be at a platform. There are sponsors, there are people, or even CEOs, are handcuffed to the narrative of the organizations. They come onto these things to say, and you have to say everything's going to be all right because we're the great innovators. And then even at the multilateral level, the numbers will be stated, but in terms of then digging into what needs to change, that becomes very problematic. Because then you start talking about things like the distribution of wealth, the resource distribution around the world. But you also then start talking about the most inconvenient one, which I address in my second book on the sustainable state, that the role of the state essentially becomes very different from the mainstream narrative, and dare I say, which is the tension in the world between the neoliberal Western economic democracy will solve all problems narrative, that this is how we are going to address the issues. And you have to then start to be questioned. And so that's the reason a lot of people don't want to get into that deep detail. And so catchphrases like "we can solve the problem with net zero" allows everyone an easy, comforting sort of narrative to embrace,
yep,
without having to go into the detail.
Chandran, does that in some way just relieve everybody's consciousness? You know, it gives them a good conscience in relation to, I can subscribe to that that headline, but the reality is somewhat different. Is there that
Absolutely.
Going on?
Absolutely. It's conscience, but it's also, and this is where I think it's really important, it also allows them to maintain their self-interest, if I can use that word in a kind way. You know, we can use the word self-interest in many ways, but kind way. If you're a CEO of a large company, and I've been on platforms that sells, what I would loosely term non-essential foods, like junk food, it's very difficult for you to essentially get into an honest conversation about the spectrum of the issues of sustainability, because your entire business model is in question, right? Your entire business model is in question. So it's easier to say we care about those other parts of the world and we're going to recycle a bit of plastics and this and that, without actually addressing the issue of junk food, obesity, sugar, all the health impacts and all of that, because that nobody wants to go into. So it's conscience, but it's also the inability to confront the realities of their own lives and their self-interest. And that's, I think, the essence of leadership in the 21st century. I made a note that one thing I wanted to say on this program,
yes,
for me, is that there are many dimensions of leadership. You know that much better than me. Many types of leadership, many different expressions of leadership, and different situations demanding different forms of leadership. But for me, in the times we live in, and for me, that our times, I think the science is very clear, our times are going to be marked by the existential threats of our time. The pandemic is the warning. The food security issues are coming. The climate change issues are coming, etc. So leadership, in my view, in our times, is about thought leadership. And thought leadership requires you to be intellectually honest, as inconvenient as it may be. And then if we are intellectually robust, then maybe we can start talking about what is real innovation. The waterless toilet, for instance.
You know, Chandran, I knew this would be a thought-provoking episode, and that's why I was very much looking forward to it and grateful for your time. I've got two teenagers. I genuinely sometimes worry about what is the world going to look and feel like for them as they grow up. I've certainly got a daughter now living in Thailand in some ways who feels more comfortable in Asia, actually, than living in the Western world for a whole host of reasons. You're talking about huge existential threats. And as you say, the pandemic was a warning of how globally impactful they can be. How do people really start to think and embrace these threats? Because they're just so big that, do you find that many people think they're just too big to try and solve? There's nothing that I can do, or there's nothing that my corporation can do, or indeed there's nothing my government can do because it's just too big? Do you find that in some ways people are hesitant, so it's just lip service and rhetoric as opposed to, you know, real action? I don't know. What are you seeing in that, in people's willingness to embrace that size of challenge?
I mean, that's why I do what I do. And some days it seems harder than others, but I am convinced that there is a point at which the science, the evidence becomes so clear that we will have a switch. And, you know, coming back to your daughter, for instance, living in Thailand, what people like them need to be able to do is start to be not seduced by simplicity. And that's one of the problems that even the education system, particularly in the more developed countries and in the more elite education institutions in this part of the world.
Yeah.
Seducing people with very simplistic answers, right? So people like her have to go and look at the science and look at the data and then ask pronounced questions. Now, as you said, but business leaders, I don't think can cop out. I don't think they should. If they do, and we and not everyone's the same, then you and I need to not call them leaders anymore. They shouldn't be on shows. They shouldn't be on, you know, leading media platforms pontificating about climate when they don't know zip about what the real essence of the transformation needed. But if they do, then there are very simple things, and I don't have time to get into it, that they can do in looking at their business model.
Right.
That at a political level, absolutely, if you do not address this, you should not be in political office. Now, people need to understand that politicians, as self-serving as they are, respond to stimulus from their electorate. The electorate need to be better informed, demanding much more rigor, and then I think politician. But can I just make one more point? There's a great difference between the politicians in developed economies and in developing economies.
Okay.
So I think that, you know, an Indonesian prime president will be able to connect these things because he knows most of my people haven't even started to be on that, you know, consumption economy that's taken for granted. I need to do something before we actually destroy the country. They understand that. And that's where, you know, I see a difference. And that's where political systems really do matter.
You know, Chandran, you used a phrase when we chatted before we were doing this episode. You talked about relentless consumption. In some ways, I feel as guilty as anyone in relation to that. But tell me a little bit about, again, what you see, this relentless consumption of us at an individual level, at a corporation level, at a national level. Are we on a path that is really not leading to a very good place at the moment, Chandran?
Well, we're certainly on a path that is not leading us to a good place. And, you know, you don't have to take my word for it. You can listen to any of the speeches done by the UN Secretary General in recent months at the last COP. But you can listen to the top scientists. Don't take my word for it. So the evidence is very clear. Just to give you one number.
Yes.
I mean, at the moment, you know, all the mammals on the planet, that includes human beings, of all the mammalian sort of biomass, that's the weight of mammals on the planet, 96% is made up of humans and the animals we eat. I think it's about 64% things that we're going to eat, chickens, cattle, etc., sheep. Then there's human beings, about 34, and only 4% now is animals and wildlife. It used to be complete reverse 1,000 years ago. And why? Because human population exploded, but our explosion has come through a method of organizing our societies. In modern terms, we would call it the economy, in which we see no limits, no constraints to human survival, to human consumption. And, you know, I don't need to tell you, we eat more meat than we need to. Right. And I'm not, you know, preaching vegetarianism, but we just eat too much. So the relentless consumption is embedded in the economic model. The model that was built out of, you know, maybe 200 years ago.
Yep.
But 200 years ago, the world's population was a billion. There seemed to be a lot around. We don't have that anymore. And the entire economic model is premised on what I call buy things you don't need with money you don't have. Right. And then an economic system that allows you to borrow and create debt, buy things you don't need with money you don't have to impress people you don't like if you're middle class.
You know, Chandran, I wonder whether we're living a self-fulfilling prophecy in some ways. So what I'm hearing is that actually the model within which we operate and live actually in some ways is outdated. It's not fit for purpose
completely
because our population completely has exploded, and with technological advances, and we're, you know, now we say, don't we, the world is a small place because you can get anywhere, just like you and I have traveled halfway across the world. What needs to happen then to just the model within which we operate on a day-to-day basis? Have you got any thoughts about what do we need to do? It sounds like we need to start to do something now, but what are your thoughts?
Yeah, you know, so there's no perfect world, let's face it. 8 billion going to 10 billion. The human species is the most dominant species on the planet, and we now need to navigate how we treat the planet, or we ourselves are going to create catastrophic declines of our own population. So there is no shortcut to it, and I call it, what do we need to do? Draconian measures.
Right.
And draconian measures will require things like, Chandran, you can't have a car. And by the way, if you have a car, you'll be allowed to drive 100 kilometers per week max. And the price of gasoline will be, what's it in the UK today? It's, I don't know, per gallon.
Say about £1.50, probably slightly less than that.
Okay, it'll be 10 quid. 10 quid, you can go 100 kilometers. But by the way, we'll build the best public transport system in the world, and you will be able to afford it. So it's taking away this idea of, you know, mobility as cheap and affordable as possible, and then creating myths around, you know, driverless cars and electric vehicles and all of this without people really understanding all of these things are going to be slightly useful, but they're not going to solve the problem. So draconian measures, I think, is what I talk about. Very unpopular, inconvenient, but we don't have a right to everything we want anymore. I think this is where I will say something that might come across as rather, you know, harsh. But this is where liberal democracies sit very uncomfortably with the notion of sustainability.
Right.
But if you're Sweden, it's kind of easy to navigate. You know, there's like, what, 6 people who live there, something like that. And it's not so difficult. But if you are Indonesia with 400 million people, India, China, Nigeria, you got a problem. And you're going to have to reconfigure the nature of where, by which people are organized, therefore what the economy is, but ensure that the most of them have the basic rights of life, which is, you know, I call water, sanitation, housing, food safe and secure, and those things. There is no substitute, in my view, if you ask the question, for draconian measures to reorganize our societies and therefore new political philosophies. I don't have a right to a car, period.
Now, Chandran, one of the things that I'm thinking about was, and is, just how difficult it is to change behavior. I think we saw that during the pandemic when perhaps, let's say, lockdown number 3, we could see that non-compliance was rising and people just refused to do certain things. And then there's an entire debate. We could have an entire episode on state legislative behavior. And, you know, we've got to have some form of regulation and understanding of how we behave. But you're talking about fundamentally shifting people's behaviors, perhaps in one part of the world, so it has a significant impact on another part of the world. How on earth do we even start to think about that?
Yeah, I mean, I've written about it because my book, The Sustainable State, are talking about this particular issue about the role of the state, and there's no substitute, emphasize the point that liberal democracies in the West will find this transition very, very difficult. The pandemic exposed it. You know, people say that the U.S. President is the most powerful man in the world, but he can't even get his citizens to wear a mask. So the rest of the world, we were looking at that in the early days, as tragic as it was, as many people died in the United States and across Europe, and said, this is freedom gone wrong. Freedom gone wrong. People didn't understand the collective contract. In Hong Kong, where I am, I came back, I remember, in March 2020, when the pandemic was beginning to be a global issue. And I came into Hong Kong and I saw all this, and we had just gone through 6-7 months of the protests, etc. There was half the population were, you know, rebelling against the government. But as soon as the pandemic started, all the Hong Kong people were wearing masks. So I come into Hong Kong after having been away for about 2 weeks, and I say, here we go again, Hong Kong people, paranoid, wearing masks, buying all the toilet paper up, and, you know, just getting paranoid. And for a week, I didn't wear a mask. And then the law hadn't been put in place either. But without any law, and a lot of people are having anti-government sentiments at that point, etc., just wearing masks. They didn't need any rules. They understood the social obligation. A week later, I was wearing a mask because I had been educated to understand my obligation to protect others, right? So I think this is also cultural.
I was going to say, I think this is a cultural
it's
thing.
It's very cultural.
And, you know,
it's
having
a cultural thing.
Just been in Hong Kong and been in Thailand and going to Singapore in a few weeks, there is a huge cultural difference between those environments, those countries. And then when I come back here, I've just come back from New York, Chandran. Obviously, I'm now here again in London. I'm aware, we're all aware of the cultural difference. And so how, we've got to take that into account. We talk about culture within organizations, but culture within nations as well. Very difficult, isn't it, to shift an entire population culturally, perhaps?
Very difficult, but, you know, so I think in the West, this is going to be a real challenge. And the culture issue is very important because in these countries, there's that disdain for authority. And I think this is what liberal democracy has done, said, you know, we have democracies, they're great. We will vote in the party we want. But from day one, we will look out to undermine them,
right,
bring them down if we can. And we don't need to respect anything because we're a democracy. I can do whatever I want. In other cultures, it is very different. I mean, I don't know if you're aware, but when the SARS epidemic first broke out in 2003, Japanese were wearing masks. And even in Asia, we were like, oh, here go the crazy Japanese doing their extra diligent ways of, you know, protecting themselves. But in Japan, it's just understood. And I think what I'll sum it up as, Adam, is that there's an understanding in these cultures that collective welfare precedes individual rights. So to your point, is it going to be very difficult in Europe? I think very difficult, but I think an awareness will start. I think the United States will be terribly difficult. But from a global perspective, I don't think that will be so difficult because cultures are different and governments have the ability to create a new political philosophy of awareness about limits, collective welfare, and the catastrophic outcomes if they do not become aware of the need to live within constraints.
You know, Chandran, for many years, am I right in saying that the West has influenced the East, or in some ways the West has suggested it has many of life's answers which the East should accept? Is that a fair comment, firstly? And secondly, do you see a time when the East may be able to influence the West in relation to some of these global matters?
I mean, I think that's a very fair comment. It's an accurate comment. And it's not just the East, it's the world.
Yeah.
My latest book talks about this in a more detailed fashion. But what we have here in this part of the world, our institutions, our way of thinking, et cetera, is all borrowed from the sort of canon of Western knowledge and philosophies, et cetera, and most recently, political structures, you know, because most countries in the region, Africa, been colonized from anything from 300 to, you know, 150 years. So, and you also have to remember the world's population was only 4 billion, half 40 years ago.
Right.
So we've exploded.
We have.
Right? 200 years ago, the world's population was only a billion. So these ideas from the West, because of the history of colonization, essentially became the basis on which to think about the economy, governance systems, etc. Now we are learning we need very, very different ways of thinking about how we organize our economies, our political systems, and the way we look at how do we, you know, use technology. How do we look at international relations? And that's the big sort of reversal and what I call relearning that policymakers in this part have to learn. I argue very strongly that Western political leaders, and I think Europe should take the lead in this,
right,
need to accept that the world has moved on and they have a lot of unlearning to do if they are really willing and honest to understand the impact of history and the need to change. I think the United States is a different issue altogether, but I think Europe could lead the Western world in this appreciation. And I think the European population are willing to understand a new social contract. It just need, but it'll take a bit longer. But where the political leaders willing to say we need to do this, there are some who are willing to, and that should give us hope.
Chandran, do you think that leaders today, one of the toughest challenges they've got is actually to unlearn, as opposed to learn? I know there's a combination of the two here, but very difficult for someone with 25, 30 years experience, who in many ways believes that they've seen it all, know it all, to unlearn. How difficult is that going to be for the senior leaders in our government and our organizations?
Yeah, I mean, I think the word unlearn becomes very uncomfortable. Because you're saying like you learned all the wrong things. But I like to think that word is also slightly uncomfortable, but being more intellectually rigorous,
right,
rather than saying intellectually honest. So if you then become intellectually rigorous, then you are beginning to unlearn, because that intellectual rigor will help you understand that there's no such thing as net zero. Therefore, we need to do this. There is no such thing as a full circular economy unless we have strong regulation. There is no such thing as unfettered freedoms, right? So I think that's why I use the word intellectual dishonesty, obviously, to provoke an idea. Yes. But I think intellectual rigor must be the basis for leadership. And if people embrace intellectual rigor, then they begin to unlearn, and it's humbling, but it doesn't make you feel inferior or that you have, you know, wasted the last 20 years or 30 years of your life.
Right.
But change is constant.
Yes,
you have to cope with that, and by being intellectually rigorous, and that's a safe place to be.
And being genuinely curious as well. I want to finish off on the topic of leadership, which we've touched upon. I'm putting my glasses on now, Chandran, because I saw a post that immediately caught my attention, because we talked about leadership today, and depending on where you look is depending on the answer you'll get. You know, I think you gave the example of the management guru might talk about agility and authenticity. The professor from a business school might talk about digital transformation or strategy execution. The politician might have something vague reserving people for their own self-serving aspirations. So what's the answer? Really, what does the modern day leader of today, Chandran, really need to focus on?
I mean, you know, for me, it depends on which country, obviously.
Okay.
It depends on what your portfolio is. And it depends on how committed you are to the constituency. So for me, the modern leader needs to understand. And that's a fundamental understanding. And some may differ in what they, you know, in their view of this. But for me, you have to understand, we live in a world with 8 billion people. It's going to 10. Whether you're in the UK, whether you're in Canada, or whether you're in Singapore, that, you know, we're connected in one way or the other. Wars today are not just fought on a battlefield somewhere in Europe or in Africa or Asia. They are fought also in the economic space of commodities, fertilizers, and all of those things. So you have to understand that whoever you're serving, we have to fundamentally change the trajectory that you spoke about, the collision course we're on. You have to understand that.
Right.
And, you know, I could do a workshop with any leader, political, business, or academia, and say, whatever your portfolio is, that question is directly linked to how you perform your job, right? How you perform. You have an obligation, if you're a politician, to explain to your constituency, whether it be in York in the UK, or whether it's Marseille in France, or whether it's Singapore, to explain the world we live in. And I've been very involved in having to explain in Hong Kong, post all the protests, that so many people didn't understand what happened in Hong Kong was the world shifted. And the world shifted, but everyone thought Hong Kong would be the same place. And people didn't understand what was going on. Politicians here didn't understand the obligation. Educators didn't understand the obligation to teach a new generation about the shift in sovereignty, the rise of China, and all of those things.
Right.
So for me, it's really important that people have a grounding in why they're doing a certain thing. But if you're ignorant of the world we live in the complexity, you can't use the excuse that's all too much for me to understand. You have to understand it, and then you have an obligation to make it very local at a leadership level, whether you're a politician or you're a business person. So if you're a business person running, you know, a cafe in London, or whether it's in Hong Kong,
yep,
you have an obligation to look at wages, fair wage. You have an obligation to look at your sourcing. You have an obligation to look at where your plastic goes. And you have a huge amount of obligations with all of that. You have the obligation to look at the meat you buy, the pricing. That's thinking about stuff. Now, I don't expect the guy who runs a cafe in Islington to think about it, but they know about this stuff. But I do expect the policymakers to start to shift those behaviors, because that's what policy is all about, right? And that's what policy is all about. And I could talk to you about, you know, why that burger is should not be £3, but it's actually £50 if you put in all the real costs. And that I think is the obligation of leaders, to really understand at a local level all the inputs that affect the people they serve, being business, academics, or politicians.
I think what I'm hearing there, Chandran, is that actually these big issues are everyone's issues, and that we must all accept some level of accountability to be aware of them, to consider our actions in that ecosystem. But as you say, as you become perhaps a leader of a larger organization, or certainly a leader from a governmental, there's just no excuses. That's what I'm hearing.
No excuse.
None.
I mean, so I could give you a quick example.
Sure.
Adam. I was in Bali last week, the Paradise Island, and plastics are everywhere.
Right.
Right. Everyone has an obligation, including now. And that was the best. We came up with a new model. It's not just about, you know, the hotel owners with great brands talking about we're going to ban single-use plastics. It's got to be much more profound. But what's interesting is now, you know, we had a model where village heads are going to have to take responsibility. And you can't just lecture. Then you have to have really good policies that start to price the what we call the polluter pay principle. And it's throughout the value chain. And then you start changing behavior right across. But you also then have to incentivize village people to do the right thing. And it's not easy in poor communities. But that's the creative thinking that has to go into these things, rather than just throwing around slogans about circularity, et cetera, and there'll be an app which will solve the problem. It's details, but it's understanding the global impacts. And the global impacts of plastics and, you know, small, these sachets of shampoo. Well, some of the global brands are going to have to ask themselves, what are we doing? Producing these little sachets of shampoo and other things and sending it to other parts of the world.
Right.
Somewhere, some government's going to say, we're going to ban all of that. And then we start thinking about, that doesn't mean that, you know, people can't have access, but there are different ways of thinking about all of this. So those are examples. Everyone's going to have to think in a leadership role And that's, I think, the fundamental point I try to make.
Chandran, we're only scratching the surface. I know that, and I hope that you'll come back onto the show and we'll continue to explore some of these themes. How can people connect or get in touch with you if they actually want to be curious and to be accountable and to learn more? So how do they get hold of you, or where should they be directed to?
Oh, they can write to inquiry at the Global Institute for Tomorrow, but they can also write directly to me. I'm not the president of some country, so it's cnaya@global-instinstitute.com.
Okay.
cnaya@global-inst.com.
And I know they can find you on LinkedIn as well, which is...
And they can find me on LinkedIn for sure.
The platform of choice for so many. Chandran, thank you so much for joining me on The Enigma. I hope that this is a thought-provoking and in some ways challenging episode for leaders all over the world, in some ways to ask themselves maybe different questions. And it's all about accountability and, I always go on about this, being genuinely curious. So thank you very much, Chandran, for taking the time to chat to me. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been a privilege. Thank you.
Take great
care. Join us again next week for more tips and strategies on the Leadership Enigma. We'd love to hear your comments on today's show, as well as suggestions for future topics and guests. Get in touch with your host on LinkedIn or visit the dedicated website, www.leadersenigma.com, powered by Transform Performance International, where you can access our exclusive learning, including books, videos, bonus content, assessments, and more. Please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe on all your major podcast platforms. Thanks for listening.